Connection is a healthy and essential aspect of our daily lives. From a warm hug after a hard day to kind words just when we need them, these gentle moments give us an understanding of life's true meaning. But when the ability to connect is interrupted by the hustle of daily life and to-do lists pile up next to the worry of who needs school supplies, sometimes making decisions about our health and the well-being of our loved ones can take a back seat. When it comes to those we care for, vaccines are one of the greatest public health success stories, and along with other measures, are one way to help prevent certain diseases. At Merck, we envision communities where families, healthcare providers, local organizations, and advocates work together. Health equity happens when every person, regardless of age and ethnicity, in every community, has fair access to healthcare, including the vaccines they need. For more information, please visit whyvaccines.com.
This October, Tanger invites you to shop pink and save lives. Your donation of $10 or more to the Breast Cancer Research Foundation helps fuel innovative research that brings us closer to a cure. It also unlocks exclusive savings from brands like Coach, Crocs, Columbia Factory Store, and more to shop all month long. Join us as we mark 30 years of advancing research and empowering hope. Donate and access your exclusive savings today at Tanger.com.
Women to Watch is an intimate look into the lives of prominent and influential women leaders from around the world and the challenges they faced on their journey. It's the real story behind her title. Join us every week to hear more stories about women from around the world and in your own communities at womentowatch.net. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another week of Women to Watch. I'm Sue Rocco. Thanks for being with me. Joining me in just a moment will be Brantley Turner. And Brantley is the new head of school, the Dwight School in Hanoi, Vietnam. And she's got a fascinating career. And we're going to be talking about, among other things, the importance of global citizenship. As always, stay with us during the breaks where you'll hear from our exclusive watch team of corporate partners. And we invite you to subscribe to our new YouTube channel at W2W Media. So that's W, the number two, Media. So now I'm very honored and excited to welcome to the show, Brantley Turner. Brantley Turner, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Sue.
It's great to have you here. And just so our viewers and listeners know, you're joining us from the United States. You happen to be in Las Vegas, but your work is in Hanoi, Vietnam, which we are going to talk about. And my guess is in most of the interviews you do, people probably start with, how does a girl from Brooklyn, New York, end up heading a school in Hanoi, Vietnam? So we're going to try to put those little pieces together. So why don't you just start with the community in Brooklyn that you grew up in? What was that like, the neighborhood?
Sure. So, you know, the path, I guess some of what we'll cover today is, and you cover with many of your guests on the show, are just sort of stories of migration. So in some ways, the journey of where I am today started before I even arrived. And my parents are from the South. So my father's from South Alabama and my mom is from Tennessee. And they met and then they moved to Brooklyn, New York in the early 70s. So in a lot of ways, like their migration was already underway.
And yeah, that's a really interesting way to look at it. Yeah, I like that.
I think that, you know, that because you're working and talking with so many women who have interesting stories, and woven through a lot of them, I think, is that movement, you know, circumstances that happened around us or to us that shaped our stories. And really, you know, I mean, my life would have been very different if my parents hadn't moved from the South. And we, not to say good or bad, but just it's a part of the story. So I'm the only person, to my knowledge, in my family ever born in the United States outside of the South as well. And everybody still lives in the South except my parents and myself. So essentially, they arrived in Brooklyn. I was born in the mid-70s there. But I always had a strong connection outside of New York. So I didn't have any other family in the North or in New York. And I spent a lot of time in Alabama growing up. So my community in Brooklyn was a diverse and very New York universe. I grew up in Brooklyn Heights, which is a nice neighborhood just across the bridge from Manhattan. really, you know, spent early years there, but also lived in San Francisco for 3 years as a child, just connected to my father's work. So had an opportunity already to be moving a little bit, and then came back to New York, and have, you know, went to school walking distance from home, and it was pretty tight little universe there. But I think a great place to grow up. A lot of people think it's, how did you grow up in New York? But if you've spent any time in the part of New York that I grew up in, it was a pretty great place to be a kid, actually.
You know, I think I mentioned to you, my daughter lives in Brooklyn and she's in Fort Greene, and we visit quite a bit, and I can see and watch the families with the children and how they live there, and you know, what, how their lifestyle is different, certainly from the suburbs. And it's a wonderful experience. So tell me a little bit about, I understand your first visit to China was at age 17, and that was due to mom and dad's work, bringing them there. What did they do?
So when I was 17, my parents left New York and moved to Hong Kong. I didn't go with them because I was really about to graduate from high school, you know, so it was just not the right time. But I wound up all of a sudden spending time in Asia, and having never been anywhere near Hong Kong when they moved, and not knowing anything about it, to be honest. And it's funny to think about like that moment in history, because we were really focused. So this was 1993, right? The internet was becoming a part of our lives in a way that I think took a lot of our mind share. And so, you know, they moved, and subsequently, right, if it had been much later, we would have been able to get a lot of information about that move and about Asia before going. But there wasn't as much internet access. So it was kind of like, hey, what is this place? And, you know, what language do they speak? And what am I to understand? So I really dove in just through opportunities to visit, in learning a lot about that part of the world. And essentially what happened was, the summer before I started college, so that was the summer of 1994, I spent most of that summer in Hong Kong, and I got to travel to Beijing with my mom for her work. So my mom worked for IBM and my dad was a lawyer. And so I got to travel to Beijing with my mom. She was doing work for IBM there. And I decided to take Mandarin when I started college. So that's kind of where my own personal journey intersected with their career developments.
Yes. Did you have siblings?
No, I'm an only child.
You're an only child. So you, did you spend some time actually home alone when they had to go ahead of you?
No. So
at 17?
No, very good question. I went to boarding school, but I was already there when they left.
Okay. Okay. So the decision to take Mandarin, I mean, the visit, I would say first, was your first introduction to Asia. And if I were to ask you, what's your first memory of thinking, wow, at this place, you know, I want to learn more, as opposed to someone else could have had that same experience and gone there and missed home and not decided to dive in and learn more about this very different culture.
It's so interesting. And I've thought a lot about it, because when we think about, and this is related to everybody's story, right? When we think about opportunities in life, and opportunities that present themselves to you, and which ones you choose to take and which ones you don't. And, you know, in my case, right, that decision to take Mandarin became such an important one for me, and arguably intersected with history well, because China was opening and there were so many opportunities. And, but very, very equally, I could have just, as you say, taken a trip and got something from it and passed it by. And I think that what gripped me about it was that I was really interested in people and history and stories, and I really didn't know anything about China. I didn't know Beijing was the capital of mainland China the first time I went. And so I all of a sudden discovered this whole new universe of stories and insights. And the reality is, right, China's an ancient culture. So whether you're interested in architecture, whether you're interested in food, you know, whether you're interested in inventions like the printing press or gunpowder, right? So many things happened in China historically that I just was continuously interested in those stories and had the access and the opportunity to travel and study. And then I got really interested in Mandarin. And a lot of people, look, Chinese is a tricky language, but the reality is, as an English speaker, you can learn to speak Chinese fairly easily, just in the sense that grammar is not radically different than English. Reading and writing is another.
Right. Wow.
Yeah. From an oral child, if you can hear the tones, there's four tones in Mandarin. If you can hear the tones, you can, I think it's not as inaccessible as a lot of people think.
Now that's interesting, because my next question was, I would assume Mandarin, the language, learning it would be very difficult. I mean, it's not something that when I think of myself in, back in the day in school, I would not have attempted that. I took French. And my, you know, my assumption was that French was probably a lot easier than Mandarin or any type of Asian language. So I was going to ask you, you know, how were you in school? Was school easy for you? Did you get, you know, were you at the top of the class or did you have to work hard in your studies?
That's a great question. And in a lot of ways, right? I never left. So I obviously like-
Correct. You're still in education for sure. Yes.
So I had a lot of privilege to go to really good schools with really great peers. And so I think it's hard to say, was I at the top of the class? You know, where did I fall academically? Because I went to school with many people far, far more intelligent than myself. I liked school and I liked to read and I had a lot of positive relationships in school, whether that was teachers or coaches or mentors, peers. So school was a very positive place for me growing up.
And was it co-ed, Brantley? A co-ed boarding school?
So I spent 3 years when I was a young kid in a all-girls school in San Francisco, but then I went to a co-ed school in Brooklyn. And then I left that school to start 10th grade and I went to a co-ed boarding school. But okay. I think this is going to maybe be a bit of a segue from your question, but what I think it came down to for me and how Mandarin intersected with me being able to successfully learn the language and also, I guess, do well in school over the years is for me all about the creative process. So I really like challenges. I like puzzles, things that require strategy and complexity to solve. And definitely have always been willing to dedicate myself to complex tasks that require a lot of focus. So Mandarin was, at the end of the day, like hours. How many hours did I put in? And the same thing. And I went to schools that really supported the creative process. And I had a lot of opportunities in the arts and not to say that just the arts are creative, but I had a lot of exposure to, I think, just getting to be creative. And, you know, everybody talks about innovative now, but to me, at the end of the day, it all starts with creativity and that space to be creative in whatever you're doing. And for some reason, the puzzle of learning Mandarin just like fit into that value for me.
Mm. You mentioned sports, I think. Did you play sports?
I did. So I always played sports at school, loved sports, and I played competitive squash.
Oh, wow. That's awesome. So let me, you know, it sounds when you describe your childhood, you know, into teenage years, that's exciting. That's not the typical norm for, you know, to go to Hong Kong for mom and dad's job. And you kind of embraced it, it sounds like. What was difficult for you in those younger years? What were you questioning, if anything, as a young girl trying to figure out, you know, your place in the world?
I was alone a lot as an only child and was very, very comfortable with adults and less comfortable with broad circles of peers. So always had close friends and was good friends with those, but really navigating that space of becoming an adolescent and into the teenage years and feeling confident and feeling comfortable. And I think there's so much language available to us now to think about vulnerability. And if you want to go as far to say shame and how that functions in our culture, both for boys and for girls. And I think at the time I felt a lot of those emotions, but didn't necessarily have a way to articulate them. And so if I look back and I think about what was tough, I think what was tough for me was what's tough for a lot of young people. Now, we didn't have social media, which I do think exacerbates a lot of those challenges and insecurities. And so it was just feeling like I had space to express myself and to be understood. And you know, another thing about still working in education is I watch this in the teenagers around me all the time now.
And yeah, I bet.
Right. And my heart really like bleeds for them. And like, I can put myself yeah. into that situation of what it felt like to be a young person going through the challenge of growth and development and selfhood. And I mean, again, I was lucky because I had exposure to really wonderful people in that process. But, you know, you think about how vulnerable those years are of, as a teenager. So yeah, goodness. I mean, I guess the move to Hong Kong could have gone like terribly off the rails. And luckily
it could have. Yes. 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 And when I think about, I mean, we could talk all day about education, and I am excited to talk to you about that. And I am always curious about the differences today for young people versus when we were in school. And certainly I think today they have more to worry about. Just in general, you know, living in this global society that we do, where we do know what's happening around the world every day, all day long, that's a lot to know for young people. And I wonder how you address that. Or by the way, has the school officially opened, or it's opening? It's not. Okay.
A couple months. So we're on track yeah. for our planned opening, which is this August.
Okay. So just so our listeners know, as the head of Dwight School Hanoi, it's going to be one of many Dwight schools, and this is the newest location. So maybe you can speak to the, you know, the policies in all of the schools that have been around since the 1800s, if I'm correct, 18, what was the founding?
Dwight, New York, yeah. 1872. Yeah.
1872. That's amazing. And I will tell you, I hadn't been familiar with, the Dwight School, but I wonder how administrators and teachers, how they address these big global worries that children have today that we just did not have. What types of things are being done?
I think, so a couple quick things on the Dwight School. So Dwight School, New York, 1872, it's been under the management and ownership of the same family for the last 80 years. And that's very unique, especially in the independent school space, just because family-owned businesses in the education realm have been, you know, largely bought up by larger education by this time. And the other thing that's unique about Dwight is more than 50 years ago, under the leadership of our chancellor, Stephen Spahn, who is still involved and in his 80s, Dwight became an international baccalaureate school, so adopting a different curriculum than would be commonly, and certainly at that time, more than 50 years ago, very uncommon in the U.S. And we are IB World Schools in all of our locations. So just briefly, New York, London. London's more than 50 years old, the school. Seoul, Shanghai, Dubai, an online school, and now Dwight School Hanoi, as well as a school in New Jersey called Franklin that's new. We were traditionally two brands, Dwight and Franklin, and they merged over time and became Dwight, and we kind of rebranched off with Franklin in the last few years. So in short, some of the curriculum decisions that Dwight made in adopting the IB meant that there became a language for talking about international mindedness and kind of global footprint. And many of the students at Dwight School, New York, over the years, and this is certainly true at our other campuses, are international students. So we have many, many passports in all of our schools, Brazilian classmates, French classmates, Japanese, you know, American. And I think that some of that exposure creates an opportunity to talk about what's going on in the world from a range of different perspectives. And, you know, and everything is perspective, right? It's something that I am very comfortable with. And getting back to your first question, right? This, I'm from New York, but I have this really strong Alabama connection to a very small town in South Central Alabama. And there's a lot of paradox. Like there was a lot of conflict or difference between what my family's life in South Alabama was and what my upbringing was in Brooklyn, New York. And I was always able to sort of sit with those paradoxical ideas and kind of hold them and examine them and not jump to the sort of one is right and one is wrong in this very kind of judgmental way of thinking about how other people think and feel. That's benefited me greatly in living abroad and working to establish, you know, schools abroad And I also think it's the reason I work for the Dwight schools and I haven't worked for a different school group, and it's been now 15 years that I've been doing work with Dwight, I have found a space where I felt very comfortable in terms of leadership and ownership at the school in accepting, thinking about things from different viewpoints and making sure that we make space for that. And that's so relevant now.
So relevant. And really I'm not going to use the word cure, but so many of our issues and problems would be solved if there was this global tolerance and curiosity of other ways and acceptance. And it really comes down to, you know, those conversations and wanting to get to know people and wanting to understand the why of what they do, whatever that might be in their culture, right?
It's critical. And within our own culture, I mean, I can't imagine a universe in which I would only speak with people that I agree with. That makes me very uncomfortable.
Because yeah.
I don't think it's good for the world.
Well, it's boring also.
It's terribly boring.
It's so boring. So I think that's really important. And of course, the children today are learning that. And just as you mentioned about not having language for certain things growing up, there is language today for, you know, people's feelings and emotions, which it's amazing. It took us so long to figure that out, the importance of that. And we should allow a space for children to be able to talk about what they're feeling and going through. Listen, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, I want to dive right into, you know, what is it like to open a brand new school in Hanoi? And we'll talk about the Dwight School a little bit more. Stay with us as we go into our first break and you'll hear from our watch team. I'll be back with Brantley Turner.
Hi, I'm Christy McCaffrey, founder and owner of Be The Good Media, and I'm here to share with you some good news. I wanted to share with you today a story about a woman named Tiffany Job. At just 37 years old, as a wife, mom, and nurse, Tiffany was blindsided with a diagnosis of advanced non-small cell lung cancer. Statistically, the prognosis is grim, but thankfully, Tiffany has responded rather well to the molecular targeted therapy she's been receiving. Not long after her diagnosis, Tiffany said that she told her husband, Nick, that she refused to leave this earth without making a positive impact. So her and her husband then set out to create a nonprofit called 10 for 10 Million. And their goal is really to encourage reoccurring donations of $10 per month in honor of the 10 million people who die annually from cancer. All of the funds collected go directly towards research. I have just found that Tiffany's attitude towards her own situation, but also towards life in general, is just so positive. I had her on the podcast, on Be The Good podcast, and I had this conversation with her, and I just left the conversation buzzing. I couldn't believe how this woman has overcome so much and yet still has the energy and the passion to do more for others. You can hear more of our conversation at bethegoodmedia.com, and there you'll also learn how Be The Good Media helps to amplify impact-driven missions and causes. Again, I'm Christy McCaffrey. Listen here for more good news on Women to Watch.
Hi, I'm Dawn Zier, and I'm thrilled to be back as a Watch Team contributor to share leadership advice for aspiring women to help them advance in their careers. It's hard to believe that it's been 5 years since I was last on the show as the CEO of Nutrisystem with my weekly segment on career advice. So what have I been up to? I've been watching and learning. Since we sold Nutrisystem, I've been sitting on several public and private company boards, doing speaking engagements, and have become a trusted advisor to Fortune 500 senior executives through my work with the Exco Group, a firm of experienced CEOs, board directors, and global business leaders who offer real-world experience to help organizations and senior executives unlock their full leadership potential. As someone who likes to connect the dots across industries, I found that powerful leadership does not live in silos. There are learnings everywhere. Some of the topics we'll explore in future episodes are leading with intention, being in the driver's seat of your own career, building your personal brand, dealing with workplace aggression, how to have those tough conversations, and my personal fave, lead, follow, or pass. I have two quick tips for female leaders before I close. Be a hand raiser and don't overthink things. Do not spend a lot of time contemplating whether you're qualified or good enough when an opportunity arises. Push that door open and walk right through. If you hesitate for too long, somebody else will take your seat. I've found in general that guys are much less likely to overthink and be self-critical. Please follow me on LinkedIn at Dawn Zier. And if you're a senior executive looking to grow in your career, visit excoleadership.com to learn more.
Welcome back to the show. I'm joined this week by Brantley Turner. And Brantley is the head of what's going to be a brand new school in Hanoi, Vietnam, Dwight School of Hanoi. And in the first segment, Brantley, we talked a little bit about global citizenship and how, you know, the world is really getting smaller with the internet. And I have a quote here. You said, "I'm always someone who is looking for commonalities as opposed to differences. And it can be difficult." And I wanted to ask why. What were you referencing when you said that?
So much of the way people from different cultures, different backgrounds, and different experiences interact with each other is about their uniqueness or their individuality. And I don't want to say that that's a bad thing. However, if it divides us and creates barriers for understanding and communication, it does become problematic. So when I'm interfacing with folks from different cultures, and obviously, I mean, I lived in China for a long time, as you know, and I now live in Vietnam, I am so interested in the experiences that make us human and connect us sort of universally. It's so powerful to be able to relate to people as opposed to just look at the way in which we're different. And I think so much of the way that we're geared to think about people that are different to us is to think about problems or barriers as opposed to the things that we share.
And right. And the differences are sometimes, or not, they're typically about traditions and perhaps the way someone dresses or the way someone speaks, when really the most important part is what's happening underneath. And I think we all as humans have the same exact desires and yearnings in life.
Absolutely. And we want fundamentally similar things. I mean, we want safety and security and peace of mind and love, you know, and it's, if you can focus on those fundamental human emotions and conditions, I think.
This October, Tanger invites you to shop pink and save lives. Your donation of $10 or more to the Breast Cancer Research Foundation helps fuel innovative research that brings us closer to a cure. It also unlocks exclusive savings from brands like Coach, Crocs, Columbia Factory Store, and more to shop all month long. Join us as we mark 30 years of advancing research and empowering hope. Donate and access your exclusive savings today at Tanger.com.
Most tax pros leave a message.
It's Jane. I'm moving on to a TurboTax expert who beat your price. Adam Devine, tell him how I feel.
Hey, tax pro, she's been thinking twice. Best believe TurboTax will beat your price.
Switch to a TurboTax Live expert and we'll beat what you paid your pro last tax season. Make the switch at TurboTax.com/beat your price. TurboTax full service only. Sign up by 12/20/2024 and file by 4/1/2025. Full details at TurboTax.com/beat your price.
At Humana, our Medicare Advantage plans give you coverage and care you can count on, along with guided support to help you feel your best. You could have a plan with a $0 premium or an all-in-one plan that may include medical and prescription coverage, as well as routine dental, vision, and hearing. Learn more at GetHumana.com. Humana, a more human way to healthcare. Humana is a Medicare Advantage HMO and PPO organization with a Medicare contract. Enrollment in any Humana plan depends on contract renewal.
It opens up the world to you in a way that is peaceful and connected, as opposed to disrupted and, you know, not peaceful, frankly.
Yeah. How do you feel about, people talk about one universal language. What's your take on that? Is it possible? Would it help? Should we not let go of our own cultural language where we came from? And again, all the traditions, because I think what's difficult sometimes is wanting us to all treat each other as human beings, but then we're placed in groups depending on where we come from. And there's a different, I would say there's a different level of importance for some people to hold on to those things, and for others, to not as important to them. So it's kind of a rambling question, but
totally. But okay, so let me throw a few ideas out there for that. So number one, I'm a firm believer in holding on to one's mother tongue language, whether you live in your own country of origin or not, because language is culture, and it is so important to stay connected to that which is unique to you as your from your own culture. And so I think the idea, right, that we, I think the question of universal language is a question of access. So it's important to encourage folks to be educated in a way that gives them access and gives them more opportunity. And very bluntly, that opportunity is English language. On the other hand, it's a tragedy to think of cultures which are moved so far away from their own language that they lose the ties to those traditional cultural values and heritage, you know, whether they're religiously oriented holidays or their other, you know, fundamental rituals to their culture. I think we also need to encourage cultures to maintain those ties, because I think there's so much value in tradition. So I think it's both. And that's ideally what good education does, is give individuals access to languages that are going to create opportunities for them, but also not pull them away from the cultures from which they come, because that's identity.
Correct. That sense of self, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Have your travels in life helped you become more self-aware?
I wrote to some girlfriends that I have a chat group with from high school just a couple days ago. I said, you can't have global awareness without self-awareness, number one. Number two, you can't have awareness if you don't understand how other people see you. And whether it's a young high schooler going through the college application process, they need to know, they have to have some self-awareness. They also need to know how that reader is going to read that application. They need to stand in that person's shoes. They can't take for granted, well, this person's going to know everything about me and not think about those perceptions that exist. So I would say completely, the starting point for kind of global awareness is self-awareness. In my personal case, it's like a work in progress. I'm sure there's lots of areas that I'm totally not self-aware, but I certainly do believe it's pointless to talk about these macro cultural, there's a lot of books written about culture and intercultural competence. And I think if you don't have some degree of self-awareness, it's very hard to get good at intercultural awareness.
So can you think of one, you know, I think we're always on a journey learning about ourselves. And I think sometimes, I think our parents' generation poked fun at the language of us saying, we, you know, the kids that went off backpacking to find themselves, and the father would say, you're right here. You don't need to go waste money. You're right here. So, but it's, to me, the more you know yourself, and why you do what you do, how and what, you know, makes you anxious or what lights you up, all of those things lead to your potential, personal and professional. And so I, you know, how could we incorporate that very, very important part of the human experience into education? How do we incorporate that into math, science, history, language?
I think that, so one of the values within International Baccalaureate that we really push in the classroom and everything is this reflection, the reflective process, and making sure that we take time for reflection, that we write reflectively, that we think evaluatively, right? There's a lot of, I don't want to call them buzzwords because they do have meaning, but they've become almost kind of buzzwords, like critical thinking, okay. You know, what does that mean? And the way you help young people think critically, which is to have a point of view and to understand different perspectives, is by helping them in reflection and helping them in hypotheses, like thinking about consequences and what could happen in a science lab or, you know, in another exploration that you're doing in school. And I think that it's, and you've touched on it, it's incredibly important to do that across all disciplines, right? So we think about, of course, we're studying English literature, we're studying the human condition, right? We're learning about people through literature. But we're also learning and need to be explorative in the sciences, and we need to be asking questions. I mean, why, you know, there's simple questions from why are leaves green? I mean, we get answers to those in school. But also we need to hone our own ability to do some of that research and some of that inquiry, right? And this is the really key thing. And definitely we don't have time today, I'm sure, to go into AI. But I think something that's very, very interesting and that we're now faced with in this traditional educational model. So let's just agree that for the last 500 years or so, we've really been focused on the idea of like, I think, therefore I am, right? Descartes gave that to us. I'm human. I think, therefore I am. The reality is now machines can think. They can think pretty fast, and they have a lot more content at their fingertips than we do. But what makes us uniquely human is how we feel, right? I would sort of say it's now going forward, I feel, therefore I am, in a way that machines can't. And so what's interesting about that is how do we as educators harness that so that we're empowering our students to have access to content, to understand it, to understand misinformation, to understand how to find good, valuable sources and utilize them well. But how do we also then understand that part of us that's uniquely human, which is that feeling component and that empathy? And, you know, where are we going to make sure that there's space for that in school, not just in literature class, right? But throughout all the disciplines. Anyway, I don't want to go too deep, but I do think about—
No, it's fascinating. Brantley, I could talk to you about it all day. I really think it's so, so interesting because it was not— you know, feelings and emotions and all of those things, as you just so beautifully pointed out, are what will always be the difference between a human being and a robot, right? We're not given enough credence in the past, in the family or in school, right? And it was and it's so obviously detrimental to children to think that those feelings they're having should not be talked about, should not be, you know, or should be suppressed, you know, right? Even worse in those moments where you're having these real feelings because you're a human being. And it makes me think about the different ways people learn, different ways students learn, and what is the approach or the process at the Dwight School that allows for the different types of learning in a classroom where there might be. And you tell me, how many kids are in a class? I'm curious.
Sure. So if we took, let's just say, average across the world at the Dwight schools, you wouldn't have more than 20 students in a class, but it would also be per section. You know, you might have 100 kids in a grade, 20 per class, but we also could have school with classes with much fewer students than that. So it depends on the location, really, for how many kids there are at the different grade levels. But, you know, something really interesting about Dwight, and again, I think at the same time that the decision was made to do this international baccalaureate curriculum, which was such an outlier decision for the US, I think also one of the programs that Dwight started, which is called Quest, we have three pillars. And one of our pillars is personalized learning. And one of the ways in which we practice personalized learning is through our Quest department, which is really, it's both a learning support department for students that have additional needs, but it's also an extension department for students who want to go further in certain areas. And it's very developed in New York, and we have it on our other campuses, and we will develop it in Hanoi. But it's really about those differences and a lot about cognitive difference. And that certainly was not a topic that was being heavily discussed when I was in school. And I really enjoy being associated with an organization that takes that cognitive diversity seriously and knows that students learn differently and puts supports in place for that. And we have students with a huge different range of support needs, and we try to make it aware to, you know, for teachers, we try to make that information accessible, because it's a radically different experience teaching a class when you know where your students may be coming from cognitively, different challenges, whether, you know, that's ADD or whether they have other needs, dyslexia. I mean, we could, you know, talk about so many different types of situations that come up in classrooms, behavioral as well. And I mean, that knowledge is really power in a teacher's hands, and you got to use it. I mean, you have to think very carefully about how to structure a class with students who learn at different paces, who have different learning needs. And the idea of personalized learning is that we do need to be able to modify that learning and instruction for students. This is so hard, and it's one of the reasons teaching is so difficult, and it's present in every single classroom, whether or not you have the privilege of being at a school like Dwight that has programs. It's at every school. Every classroom has need, kids with needs in it.
Yeah. Or even just the knowledge of, is someone a visual learner or someone, what would be the opposite of a visual learner?
So there's all different. So if we think about multiple intelligences, right? Like you can think about a kinesthetic learner who might learn more through movement. So in math, if you do blocks that are called manipulatives, right? And you're saying, okay, what's a fraction? Wait, let me move that around, right? It's tangible and visual, like you're saying, visual spatial. Yeah. Right. Seeing things in patterns differently. And so it's almost not that there's opposites, but there's this whole range of, you might have certain strength areas of your learning styles or you might have a balance. So Howard Gardner is the person who really started putting forward that idea of multiple intelligences. And yes, again, that's opened up a whole world for teachers to think differently about teaching.
Correct. EQ versus IQ, right? Something we never talked about. Can you tell us a little bit about Hanoi, and probably dispel some stereotypes or myths that people who have never been to Vietnam have?
Absolutely. So I, have arrived in Hanoi. I've been there, living there almost a year, and I spent quite a bit of time there the year before in the lead up, but really didn't have a lot of knowledge about Vietnam, before going. Everybody said I could learn Vietnamese easily because I speak Chinese. Let me tell you, my Vietnamese is terrible. I feel terribly about it. I've made very little effort. I'm trying, sort of. But it's tough, man. It is goodness. It's a language. It's really a lot of work.
I won't ask you to speak anything.
Oh,
I won't do that.
I can say hello, and I try, but my colleagues, if they listen to this, will laugh. But you know what? It's been so interesting. First of all, the people in Vietnam are amazing. They're friendly, lovely, smart, exciting. Just, we're ready to have fun and do things together. I mean, my local team, nobody puts on a birthday for other teachers like my local team in Vietnam does. And, one of the things, just quickly on language, right? Because Vietnamese language is not something that you have a lot of access to outside of Vietnam. So English is pretty strong. I mean, you can
practice.
A lot of people speak English, and there's a need for learning English just to keep that connectivity with the outside world. I've learned a lot about how practical Vietnam is, and I really appreciate that. Very little time spent talking about politics, which to me seems great. And
refreshing, so refreshing.
And it's just sort of practical in the sense of listen, Vietnam has come a long way economically since the 1980s. And people want tomorrow to be better than yesterday. And I still think there's a feeling that tomorrow can be better than yesterday. And I'm attracted to places that are optimistic. So I grew up in New York in a time when I felt like it was very optimistic. I lived in China in a time when it was very optimistic. And I feel that way about Vietnam now.
Did I read it's the fastest growing economy in Asia?
It is.
Wow. So that was surprising. And what's spurring that?
Some of that is just its regional position. Right. There's a lot of discussion around supply chain and how certain companies, right, have maybe de-risked from China a bit. So they've moved some of their supply chain or their production to Vietnam. That certainly happened. There's a lot of interest in investment in Vietnam because, for example, I was explaining to somebody yesterday at a shop, I was at a Sephora and the woman asked me do you have Sephora in Hanoi? And I said, no. But I said, and there's no Apple store and there's no IKEA and there's so much that isn't there yet. And so
Target, Costco.
So what happens when places haven't reached that level of international retail development, even you companies are focused. They're looking at Vietnam and looking for development opportunities, and that brings money and opportunity. And I mean, even
do you think
education,
do you think they want it? Do the Vietnamese want that? So you know, what can happen. It can be exciting and new and wonderful, and then things go too far sometimes.
I would say Vietnam definitely has guardrails. So for example, it's not easy to get a work permit to work in Vietnam for foreigners. So it's not just this kind of, hey, the doors are open, come one, come all. You know, there are restrictions and there are regulations. And so I think that's Vietnam should be allowed to develop as it sees, as it sees fit. And Vietnam certainly should not be told by anyone else in the world what they should be doing for themselves. I think that the history of Vietnam is extraordinary. And even at U.S. universities, from my limited research on this topic, there are not a lot of classes you can take about Vietnam other than Vietnam War. I mean, there's still...
That's all I was ever taught. That's it.
Right.
I had an uncle that, you know, was in the Vietnam War, and
I mean, it was called the American War there. But there's a history of Chinese occupation in Vietnam. There's the French colonial period and then the Americans. And so there is so much to learn about how Vietnam has defended and developed itself over centuries. And I think it's really important now to treat that history with responsibility and with respect, and certainly not be showing up saying, oh, I'm here to tell the Vietnamese what to do. No, I am totally interested in both bridging in, creating opportunity, but also bridging out. And I hope to empower our Vietnamese students or any students that attend school in Hanoi with language and a way to talk about Vietnam for the future, as opposed to everything having to be about the past. Because I think Vietnam should be in control of their narrative, and they should be allowed to tell the next chapter of their story. And I kind of see myself as just participating in that, right? I'm witnessing this moment in time.
That's exciting.
It is super exciting.
That's exciting. By the way, what's the percentage of students that will be attending Hanoi that are Vietnamese?
So TBD, I mean, the simple answer is we don't know exactly yet, but there will be a high percentage of Vietnamese national students, but also international students. And so there's an international population in Hanoi. It's not quite as large as that of Ho Chi Minh City or Saigon in the south. And so there are some limitations on international enrollment. But here's another interesting thing that I didn't know so much about before I got there. The largest international population in Hanoi is Korean.
Oh, that is interesting.
And that's business.
I wonder what brought them there.
That's business. So it's all factories like Samsung and LG and different companies and support services that have factories in northern Vietnam.
Okay. Okay. My last question for you, because I know you got to get back to it. You're opening a brand new school. I can't imagine how exciting it is to open a brand new school, and you know, you have the background, the expertise, the education, and you're going to do a super job. Do you see yourself in another place diving into any other culture outside of Asian studies where you could open another school in a place that perhaps you want to learn more about?
So what I always say to Dwight is, look, I'm here. I'm in it for the long haul with Dwight. I've had great opportunities. I started the school in China. I get to start the school in Hanoi. So the simple answer to that is I'm open, right? What opportunities come up, what the organization needs, I'm there to support and be on board. I don't have a personal area, right? I don't have a place in my mind that I have thought of personally that I really want to have an opportunity to be in. I think I'll go where the opportunities are and try to contribute when I'm there. But certainly, you know, this is my path and my interest. I love the entrepreneurial process, and I love the startup process, and probably less qualified and capable to run a school that's been around for a really long time. So if I can keep having opportunities to do things that are new and, kind of forging new paths, that's definitely where my heart is.
Yeah. How do you survive the jet lag, by the way?
I
came back from a trip to London, and it took me a week to just London. I don't know. My body did not react well to jet lag.
I used to be really good at jet lag. Just boom, hit the ground running. Simple answer is I probably drink too much coffee.
Okay.
I can sleep pretty well, so I can kind of like force myself to sleep.
Oh, good.
And just take the moments when I can. But and drink a lot of water. Try to sleep on the plane. Okay, so the one jet lag tip I would give everybody, the biggest fallacy is, oh, don't sleep. You know, don't sleep on the plane because, you know, you're going to get there and you can know. The point is, if you can sleep on the plane in particular, sleep. It doesn't matter what time of day it is, wherever you're going. You're landing at 10 o'clock at night, you slept the whole plane ride, it's okay. Because the sleep deprivation or depriving yourself of sleep actually makes the jet lag recovery slower, in my opinion.
Brantley, thanks so much for being with me. I wish you the best of luck with the launch of the Deutsch School in Hanoi.
Thank you, Sue. And thank you so much for the work you do telling women's stories, an important part of creating those great opportunities for all of us.
Coming up next, you'll hear from AJ Bishop for her Wealth Watch and a beautiful spot from CHOP. I'll be right back.
Hey, it's AJ Bishop Andrews coming to you after spending 3 glorious weeks in the beautiful city of Ladakh, India. Ladakh has been on my travel list for probably 20 years as a practicing yoga teacher as well as meditation teacher. I really wanted to have this opportunity to go off the grid and just really come internal. The moment I had while meditating at almost 20,000 feet in elevation with a bunch of monks in red robes was this realization that maybe not every woman is ready to make the transition or the leap. When I reflect back on my own personal experience, it probably took me roughly 5 to 10 years to really get to a space where I knew and felt comfortable and confident that it was time for me to leave the corporate environment. And as I've been working with women who often find me, that is what they're seeking, is clarity. And so I began to realize, what if I created a container where women could come and explore, rediscover their spark, right, without the pressure of really needing to make an immediate or drastic change? So I'm really excited to announce the birth of Spark, a new founding membership program that I'm working on, where I'm creating a safe space for women to make decisions out of strength and clarity rather than out of desperation and exhaustion. If you'd like to learn more about Spark or any of the other career and coaching programs that I offer, please reach out to me at ajbishop.co.
We are CHOP, and we can't wait to show you around. We're the nation's first children's hospital. Now, a care network with more than 50 locations that continues to expand. 3 state-of-the-art research buildings with 1.5 million square feet of space. We have grown from 12 beds 165 years ago to nearly 600 beds and one of the best children's hospitals in the world. We have a level 1 trauma center, 11 floors of patient units, more than 20 operating rooms, first of its kind delivery unit for babies with birth defects, a separate cardiac operative and catheterization suite, and places to learn, like our internationally recognized simulation center. We have trained generations of leaders in the field of pediatrics. We are world leaders in medicine, surgery, and science. One of the top recipients in NIH funding for pediatric research. In this building, pioneers in CAR T therapy, mitochondrial disease, brain tumors, hyperinsulinism, and other rare diseases. Here, groundbreaking work in fetal surgery, genetics and genomics, and neurology. In our newest building, leaders in social determinants of health, clinical informatics and epidemiology, autism, trauma and injury prevention. Our patients come from every state and 115 countries. Meeting these challenges requires the best and the brightest. We are passionate about pediatrics, we are motivated to make a difference in the world and in our community. We are a team. We are CHOP.
That's it, everyone, for another week of Women to Watch. Thanks for being with me. Next week, I'm going to be speaking with Maya Guichi, and Maya is the Director of Strategy for BRC. Thank you, as always, to our sponsors and our watch team of corporate partners, and I hope you all have a great week.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger for thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
The Humana Honor Medicare Advantage Plan gives you $1,860 back each year in your Social Security check. Choose coverage that helps you keep more money in your pocket. Learn more at GetHumana.com. Humana, a more human way to healthcare. The Part B giveback benefit pays part or all of your Part B premium, and the amount may change based on the amount you pay for Part B. Limitations and restrictions may apply. Humana is a Medicare Advantage HMO and PPO organization with a Medicare contract. Enrollment in any Humana plan depends on contract renewal.